Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for the invitation. And I'm honored to speak to such an impressive group. So Lenore asked us to talk a little bit about truth and conservatism. So I'll talk briefly about what I'll call conservatism and truth in an age of propaganda. So I think we live in an age of propaganda from all over the place. And so how to think about it. Now, these are obviously very complex things. And so I'm only going to address a couple of them, and I hope we'll have a good discussion afterwards. So I think the first thing that we need to do, I'm going to make 3 points. First, I'm going to argue that we need to be more aggressive in addressing foundational weaknesses of modern social sciences and the sciences, especially the incoherent ideas of empiricist rationality and materialist visions of man. I think basically we are kind of oftentimes playing in the stadium or the sandbox of people who are materialists and reductionists, and we don't sometimes enough go after those foundational things. Second, I think we need to be philosophical and not ideological. And this is difficult, but I think we have to try to avoid the kind of easier ideological pat responses to complex problems. And then related to the first point, use these kind of foundational tools. So I know, at least for myself, sometimes you hear an argument from something on the left, and you're like, oh, my goodness, right? But sometimes maybe slowing down, and I find this in myself. I'll give you an example of where I did this. So that's the second. And then the third is, I think it's very important to be rhetorically thoughtful, rhetorically sensitive, and wise in our engagement. And yet at the same time, avoid the temptation to simply build a brand. And slip into propaganda. And this is hard because everyone's competing for attention and good branding is important, but I think it's destructive if it undermines truth. There's a guy called Tristan Harris who does work on Center for Humane Technology, and sometimes he gives this analogy of everybody's competing to colonize the brainstem. And so we're all trying to like figure out what's the best way we can do it. And so I think sometimes there's a tension then to be as kind of audacious as we can. And I think that's, again, there's a tension there, but avoid this kind of branding and propaganda. So the first one is to address the foundational weaknesses. I think, you know, there's a lot of technical problems we have with policy, and we have to address those. But I also think sometimes, and again, a lot of this is a critique of myself. I don't want you to hear this as just like a broad critique of you. but if it applies, go ahead and take it. So there's a lot of technical things that we have to address, but I think there's also these incoherent philosophical foundations. So a couple of examples are reason. For example, the dominant idea of reason is empiricist rationality, right? That in order for something to be reasonable and rational, it must be empirically verifiable. Now, of course, that statement itself is not empirically verifiable, right? So it's incoherent on its own terms. But it also takes the fundamental human experiences that matter for society, a lot of the themes that we've discussed this weekend, love, beauty, right, wrong, truth, justice, mercy, friendship, compassion, and it relegates them outside the realm of reason. And this is a problem because it takes these reasonable emotions and either makes them kind of ephemeral, spiritual, I mean, soft-like feelings, or more likely, kind of explained by neurological processes. So, well, you don't really love her. Your chemicals are reacting to her, right? And it doesn't align. It's incoherent on its own terms. It doesn't align with our lived experience of persons, and it undermines fundamental things. So, I mean, Joseph Ratzinger, I think, is probably the clearest on this of what happens when we take justice outside the realm of reason, right? So either the purpose of politics is justice, and we're in a dialogue about this, but if justice is outside the realm of reason, then politics is reduced either to power or efficiency. So it's either a dictatorship or a technocracy. And I think we have to kind of address these things. Another example is just the fundamental questions on the human person. I was on a panel the other day. It was a very kind of progressive, secular place, and they asked, can philanthropy be empowering? And I said, well, yeah, it depends, right? It depends if it creates learned helplessness and dependency. But I said, but the bigger question is, what do you mean by philo, love, and what do you mean by anthropos, the person, man? And, you know, love is oftentimes, we've substituted love for humanitarianism, which is just, kind of this hollowed out secular vision of love that has these limited horizons that only sees love as kind of technically solving your comfort. But that's not enough. But I think even more constricted is our understanding of the person. So it's that rationality that I talked about, but also this kind of deep-seated materialism, this idea that, well, we're just basically, you know, higher-level animals, and there's no real distinction between us and, you know, a horse, for example, in yesterday's example, or we're just a machine. And I think that going to the core of these questions and really kind of saying, like, listen, this is an incoherent, reductionist approach that, as I said, doesn't align with our lived experience as persons. So what we generally have is either this kind of radical individualism or sentimental collectivism. But the human person is a subject, willed for his or her own sake, who's also a social being in relationship with one another. And too often, as I said, I think we play in the sandbox of this reductionist empiricism. So, I mean, I think, again, the last point I would say is just broadly on secularism. I mean, secularism, as we know, is not a neutral position, right? It's no more neutral than Orthodox Judaism, Orthodox Calvinism, or Orthodox Catholicism. It is a certain worldview. And too often, we kind of assume the secular assumptions as somehow true. So I think, I mean, a lot of things are good. I think this happened this week. I saw it. I think Jay Richards, I think, did a good job yesterday arguing against these kind of materialist assumptions. So that's the first, aggressively address the foundational issues and not just the technical. The second is to be philosophical and not ideological. And so I mean avoiding this temptation for the easy standard answer. Now, I do want to be clear. I do not mean what the left means by dialogue. Dialogue means capitulation to the left. I do not mean that if we're not ideological, we must be somehow become a progressive. That's what I mean. What I mean, like, is that we actually, and I, this is again a critique of myself. Sometimes I hear the argument and I'm like, oh, it's a left-wing argument. So I'm going to give a banal example and then maybe a more serious one. So I used to joke, this is changing a bit, but I said, where do left-wing, radical Obama voters, socialist progressives who want a highly regulated economy and everything, where do they go to find their community? Well, they go to highly unregulated free markets called farmers markets, right? And then you ask a conservative, what do you think about a farmers market? Bunch of hippies. Like, did you know they're unregulated free markets? Well, I don't know about that, all that organic stuff, right? I mean, and there's this kind of Burkean, like there's a whole Burkean tradition of like being skeptical of like GMOs or all this stuff. Like, oh no, conservatives are like, we need to not mess with the family. We need to be very careful. What about GMOs? I'm fine with those. I actually had a conversation. He said, there's nothing wrong. He was giving contraceptives in Africa to poor women. And he asked me, do you think it's wrong? I mean, I'm a secular person, but they're religious. But they think the pill causes cancer. I was like, well, there's a lot of evidence that it causes cancer. And he's like, well, come on. I said, well, why would you think not? He said, well, I mean, it's just like drinking water. I said, okay, so he talked about estrogen levels and everything. I said, what do you think about GMOs? He goes, oh, I'm really worried about those. I'm like, wait, so you're worried about GMOs, but not by, like, hacking the biological nature of a woman, right? And I think we kind of fall into this, too. So I think, we need to be philosophical and not ideological. So another of my co-panelists here, Mike Munger, I think he did a good example of this with his piece on cronyism in the Independent Review and his conversation on Econ Talk with Russ Roberts. Like, yeah, capitalism can lead to problems, and we have to address them. And when we do that, I think it gives us an advantage. So let me give you another example. I've been reading this book by Shoshana Zuboff called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Some of you may know it. It's about this big. And it's a critique of Google and Facebook. And I actually am very sympathetic to her critiques. But one of the arguments she gives why we have surveillance capitalism is Hayekian neoliberalism. So my first, like, oh, my goodness, here we go. You know, of course, you got to just tell, you know. And it's also, and why don't we just talk about Reagan and Thatcher? It's always their fault. And so part of my reaction was correct. But as I began to think, okay, there are some errors, right? Most of the economy is, in fact, heavily regulated. Reagan and Thatcher are dead. But I try to think about her argument. Like, what is she trying to say? And then I started to think, okay, let me, when I put it in her critique of surveillance capitalism and data mining and taking advantage of all this asymmetry of knowledge, I started thinking about the California ideology, right? And so if you take the California ideology, which is kind of like Berkeley Buddhism, radical autonomy, the sexual revolution, and then this kind of techno-utopianism, and you combine that with the worst version of Hayek, right, where you have this, you know, you ignore his point about economics being just one realm, and you combine it to his kind of evolutionary theory, well, I think she has a point, right? I think in one sense, you get these people, say, Google or Mark Zuckerberg, and Google's not a person, but you get these guys who are like in, they're kind of in the California ideology, they're separated from any sense of moral or social responsibility whatsoever, and then you give them the tool of free markets, and they take their radical free market ideology, and they say, we're going to steal your data, we're going to manipulate you, we're going to take advantage of asymmetries of knowledge. I mean, that's a radical free market problem, right? So how do we, so she's in sense right. So I think free competitive economies are very, very important, and I think they're important for the poor. So then the question is, okay, how do we make a case that, in fact, a market economy needs to be contextualized in community, person, richer understandings of life? Instead of just reacting, we can actually, so I think a lot of her diagnosis is right, but it's also wrong. And so if we have, so on my side, I know that not everybody here likes the markets. You don't have to be a free marketer to get to heaven. You just end up in the bad economic section, okay? So, but those of us who like the market say, no, let's actually take this analysis and do a better job. All right, so that's the things. We need to be philosophical and not ideological. And the third thing is I think, need to avoid the temptation to a brand that slips into propaganda. And again, as I said, this is hard to do. We want to be heard, right? We want to say something that people will attach on. And there's a lot of noise and a lot of, like, as Harris says, competition to colonize the brainstem. But we also, and we want to make these big picture arguments for discussion. But I think we need to be careful that we don't, like, overstate things and just kind of stick to a brand. So I think an example of slipping into a brand is Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed, and a lot of his work around this since his publication. Now, I actually agree with many of Deneen's worries. I'm sympathetic. I agree that Lockean individualism and the state of nature is a myth and a real problem. Yet I think his claims about Locke and the founders as somehow the source of all the problems we have with liberalism today, with the anthropological issues of transgenderism or with the totalitarian act of redefining marriage, is just not correct. Right, it's just not serious. You can't simply blame Locke and the founders. Is there something there? Absolutely. But I don't think it does justice to the founders and their religious commitments. I don't think it takes seriously the writings of, say, Washington and Adams, who were explicitly concerned with morality and liberty. I think it's overly theoretical and doesn't take into account the practice of democratic life that happened before the founding, right, and all the traditions that we got there. Somebody mentioned M. Stanton Evans yesterday. Now, he wrote this little book called The Theme of Freedom, which is a very kind of popular book. But I think just if Deneen read that book, that would be a good start, right? But it also leaves out serious consideration of Marx, Darwin, Freud, the Frankfurt School, feminism, technology, and the sexual revolution, as if those things, it's all Locke's fault, right? But the point is, not simply that it's wrong, which I think it is, and many of you in this room have actually made serious scholarly critiques of it. My point is, I think the argument has become a brand. It's this audacious, bold, attention-grabbing. It gets a lot of attention. And so why stop? Subtle arguments, I mean, what do they do? Nobody listens to those. You don't get likes on Facebook. And I think that Professor Deneen actually made it clear to us that it is a brand. About 2 weeks ago, he gave a lecture at Catholic University sponsored by First Things, which I think is also becoming a brand, where he argued, quote, we need to use Machiavellian means to achieve Aristotelian ends. We need Machiavellian means for Aristotelian ends. Now, first of all, I'm not certain you can achieve Aristotelian ends with Machiavellian means. The means might cancel them out, but that's another discussion. But careful readers will notice
that the idea that we need to use Machiavellian means to attain Aristotelian ends actually makes sense of the book. It doesn't matter whether it's correct or not. It doesn't matter whether Locke and the founders are actually to blame. It's a Machiavellian means to achieve his desired Aristotelian end. And if that is the case, and he's not here to defend himself, so maybe he could, but if that's the case, then it's propaganda. It's become a brand, right? And I understand the temptation for brands, but if brands can become destructive if they undermine the truth. So in conclusion, I would say that conservatism, future of truth, that A, number one, to recapitulate, we need to be more aggressive in addressing the foundational weaknesses of the dominant secular and materialist technocratic culture. Two, and that doesn't mean we can't do the technical side also. Two, we need to try our best to be philosophical and not ideological without capitulating to fashion. And three, while being rhetorically skilled and wise, avoid the temptation to brand and propaganda that undermines truth. Thank you.